There is a conference coming up this Saturday on models for equitable development. You've heard us debate issues of development on this program for the last 20 years. 20 years ago, our second or third show, and when we started this program out, was about public housing, was about development issues, about developing parts of our city. Those debates are still going on. And one of the people who have been in the middle of all that, the thick of that battle in this community, is with us here in the studio now, Maricela Gomez, Dr. Maricela Gomez, who is, wrote this book that you'll hear on our show soon in the next week or two, Race, Class, Power, and Organizing in East Baltimore, Rebuilding Abandoned Communities in America. She's a physician, public health professional, scientist, community activist who worked with the Middle East group here in Baltimore, challenging EBDI on how East Baltimore is being developed. She joins us in studio. Maricela, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark. It's good to be here.
We're joined by phone by Dr. Rhonda Williams. Dr. Rhonda Williams is founder and executive director of the Case Western Reserve University's Social Justice Institute. She's an associate professor of history there and author of the book, The Politics of Public Housing, Black Women's Struggles Against Urban Inequality. And Dr. Rhonda Williams, it's a pleasure to have you with us. We've been looking forward to having you on the air for quite some time.
Oh, thank you very much. Pleasure to be able to join the conversation.
We are also joined by Gus Newport. Gus Newport was mayor of Berkeley, California from 1979 to 1986. Also been looking forward to meeting him since his days as mayor, former executive director of the Dudley Street Neighborhood Project Initiative in Boston. And Gus Newport, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Pleased to be here.
We're in a minute we'll be talking to Rocky Barros, who is director of community building, Jacobs Center for Neighborhood Innovation in San Diego. But let me welcome you all. It's good to have you with us. This is great.
Thank you.
Maricela, first, give us an update about this conference, but why this is taking place and what's taking place.
Right. So this coming Saturday, March 9th, from 9 a.m. till 4 p.m., we're hosting is Sojourner Douglas College, Baltimore Racial Justice Action, Social Health Concepts and Practice, and Red Emma's Bookstore and Coffee House together are sponsoring or hosting a symposium, a one-day symposium on equitable and sustainable development. And the symposium will focus on a path forward, looking at the past, the failures, the pieces, the gems that may have been embedded in some of those failures, and looking to find out how we can share alternative models and move forward to a more equitable, a more sustainable way to do development, one that embraces and has embedded in it community at the core from the beginning, from the planning, from the visioning, community at the decision-making table, community at the implementation phase, community at the evaluation, completely embedded with community. It is the community's it is a community's neighborhood that's being redeveloped, so one would imagine that they need to be at the table to talk about accountability, to talk about transparency, and really to talk about how all these factors can come together to result in more equitable and sustainable development.
So I want to welcome Rocky Barros, who's just joined us, who is the director of community building, Jacobs Center for Neighborhood Innovation in San Diego. Rocky, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Thank you.
Looking forward to meeting all three of you when you get to Baltimore this Saturday. What I want to do is wrestle with some things here with the three of you. Let me stop. Let you describe a bit about the work you've done in neighborhood development. And then I want to kind of wrestle with some very concrete issues about how that does happen. Because most communities, see, like Baltimore, in terms of involvement of community, is at a minimal level, as it is, I think, in most cities. And why that is and what changes that and what would make a different kind of development. But let me start. Gus Newport, describe for us first the work that you were doing in Boston with the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative. What was that?
Well, Dudley was going through, Boston, his inner city, was going through changes in the mid-'80s, as most cities were. They began declining before then, but I think community people only began to recognize that declines of these inner cities were not because of the class of people who were there, but was because of failed policy. And I had, just prior to coming to Boston, been the mayor of Berkeley, California for 8 years. A city that's very active, did a lot of community engagement, but I also uncovered some of the negative approaches from a class standpoint that tried to put all the low to moderate income housing in one place, did not complement it with commercial, retail, open space, cultural institutions, and areas of commerce as well as job development. As we watch the Johnson programs from the 60s on, as they began through urban renewal to destroy or tear down many of these communities and leave a lot of vacancy, but there was no money for planning or building, so they built a lot of substandard rental housing, but they did not complement it with market-rate housing, with commercial and retail, with open space, with cultural institutions. As the middle class was beginning to move more to the suburbs, as developers had begun to do a land grab there and build malls and everything to attract the economies away from the inner city and to attract the middle class, who eventually will find out they suffered too. But it was engaging community people to make them understand that the causes of decline were not because of them, but was because of failed policy from the federal government, state government, municipal government, et cetera, et cetera. And through that engagement and planning process, we began to look at a blueprint of how those cities were first, those communities were first built during the days of town people, town hall meetings, and to plan collectively and begin to say, if you all had a chance to plan and build based on what you know now, how would you start? And that's how we begin that type of community development process.
And Ron Williams, I'm curious about your kind of, I mean, you've done a lot of work, especially looking at the historicity of it all, and talk about your involvement in this and what your academic work and how that's been involved with community where you are.
I would say, you know, Gus hit on a number of key things and some of the things he just laid out. And I think this is why history is so important and why history has to also make its way into community. My work, The Politics of Public Housing, really documents the way that public housing policy and urban policy really worked at negative odds with people in community, really re-entrenching racial discrimination, really reinforcing economic inequality, in some ways even expanding racial and economic inequality by trying to forestall the mixture of people of different races and classes in neighborhoods that were shifting by building public housing complexes in those areas to really build up those racial walls. And one of the things that I talk about in the book, which I think is really important in the kind of contemporary conversation, is the ways in which public housing tenants from the very beginning began to raise their voices about the different kinds of policies that they saw were not working to their best advantage, whether it was the ways in which public housing was built in a most minimalist way, where they had to suffer very soon thereafter moving in, seeping water and rats and other kinds of things that public housing was supposed to begin to solve in terms of getting rid of slums and blight, to really saying we want to implement a sense of community. This is a place we live. We see this as community, and therefore implement a sense of community by having recreation clubs, by having educational opportunities, by having mothers and fathers clubs, by actually seeing public housing not as a place of increasingly last resort or a place where, quote-unquote, those people go to live, mm-hmm. to a place where this is our home and our homes and our community. They need to be taken care of. Uncle Sam is our landlord, and furthermore, we are worthy and deserving people. And residents really began to speak out, and particularly against the backdrop of the emerging civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s, and also against the emerging backdrop of urban renewal and Negro removal, at the same time that used public housing as a tool at odds with some of their desires. Women like Shirley Wise and Goldie Baker and Frances Reeves, all of whom lived in Lafayette Courts, which was there right in East Baltimore.
That's right.
Was the first public housing complex to be a high-rise, to be imploded in the city. It really argued against public housing authorities to say, look, we have things that we want to do in this community. It is our community. We should have say in public housing policy. We should have say on who our managers are. We should have say in how you rehab public housing coming in with HUD modernization money. And so they had to fight for those rights. They had to fight for the establishment of a citywide resident advisory board. They were not considered in the beginning when those policies were being developed, in the beginning when modernization money was they were trying to figure out how to use that. And it's the same kind of case that we're seeing now with the overhauling, tragic demolition of neighborhood and people's communities in East Baltimore. And you see, this is not just about structures. It's not just about mortar and brick. It's about people and about the people who live there and the people having say from the very beginning. How do we get them involved in the development process? As Maricela said, from the very beginning, not as an afterthought, not to just bring them in to say, okay, we have some people on the board, not to already have imagined and envisioned what you think should be in a particular place that you see yourself as redeveloping, but really going to community and saying, what is it you desire? What is it that you want to see? What's going to benefit community? How is this going to help us think about race and economic injustice that is embedded in place and through policies? How can we begin to counteract that and still have a win-win, if that is possible, for all of us involved? But that conversation rarely ever happens. And so we have to move to a place where equitable development, racially just development, economically sound development includes the people who live in the neighborhoods and not just the institutions who want to control the space and the vision of those places.
I want to come back to what you said and kind of parse this out about some how you both theoretically and critically about how that does happen and throw up an example and have us kind of look at how this might be different. But Rocky, let me have you introduce yourself as well and your thoughts to our listeners and the work you've been doing in San Diego.
Well, you know, here in San Diego, when we came into this community in southeastern San Diego, which was in 1997, we were actually came to this community because there was a parcel of land, 20 acres, there was an abandoned factory on it, and the residents in this community, wanted somebody to do something with it. And it so happened at the time that, you know, we had made a decision as a foundation to do place-based work, and we had funded this community in the past, and so when the request was made, and folks said, why didn't the Jacobs Foundation build their headquarters here? Everything seemed to line up, and we said, okay, you know, we'll build our headquarters, and it'll help this community, you know, with taking care of this, you know, abandoned factory and these 20 acres that they would like to see developed. However, we had no plan for those 20 acres, so when we came in, we reached out to the residents and asked them, if we put our headquarters here, you know, first of all, are you okay with that? And then secondly, if we do, what else would you like us to do with those 20 acres? And from that, the residents came up actually with a list of 10 things that they wanted to see, types of business and services that they wanted to see in their community. And so that really created the vision and sort of our marching orders on what our work would be in this community. And so, since 97, we've been working with the community and with that vision and them involved in the planning and the implementation of that vision. We've developed, we went beyond the 20 acres in that, with the community decided to purchase some additional acreage, and now we're up to about 52 acres or so in this development process that we're doing here, which we base it on a sort of the social and economics. We always say it's the double bottom line in that, you know, we know we have this economic economic development project that we're leading with, but we want to make sure that we balance the social components to that in whatever it is that we're doing. So that's sort of in a nutshell the work that we've been doing here in southeastern San Diego.
So I wonder, and that was a model that when you said you came in with that, Rocky, you were saying the organization wanted to build a building, actually reached out, or the community forced the issue?
Yeah, you know, we reached out. The community requested that we, you know, do something with that land, but we reached out to the community because we looked at and said, there's folks that live right across the street from these 20 acres and surrounding and the surrounding area, and so we went to those folks first. We went and knocked on their doors and said, hey, you know, we've been asked to purchase this land and to move here. It's going to impact you the most because you live right next to it. You know, how do you feel about this? And that's how we really started this engagement process with the residents.
So, folks, if you're, I'd like you to join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Your own thoughts on this and how you think development should be happening. What's happening in your neighborhood? I remember we started the show 20 years ago. Shirley Wise was a guest on the show.
Wonderful.
Talking about those very issues at that moment. And what we're attempting to do now, by the way, to let you know is before we go to break, is we'll be down at this conference on Saturday doing some coverage and bringing it back. But we'll also be organizing a town meeting. We requested that the housing commissioner give us the dates that work for him to join us in a live town meeting to talk about public housing and public policy around housing and how that's changed or not changed in 20 years and where we're going to go, because that's a huge piece of that. And we're going to talk about a very specific example, and I'm going to ask my guests here how they think things could be organized differently right here in Baltimore. Stay with us. We'll be right back as we look at how we can develop our city in a different way than we ever have before. That's part of a conference coming up this Saturday, which we'll talk more about when we come back. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. This weekend there is something. It's called the Symposium Equitable and Sustainable Development. It is Equitable and Sustainable Redevelopment in Our Abandoned Communities, A Path Forward, taking place this Saturday. Maricela Gomez is with us, who is helping to organize that conference, along with Red Emmas and who are the other conveners?
Sojourner Douglas College, Baltimore Racial Justice Action, and Social Health Concepts and Practice.
And, of course, she's also written the book Race, Class, Power, and Organizing in East Baltimore, Rebuilding Abandoned Communities in America. And we'll have a conversation with Maricela about that book in the coming week. We're here also with Dr. Rhonda Williams. All next three guests, we're all coming to this conference. Dr. Rhonda Williams, founder and executive director of the Case Western Reserve University Social Justice Institute, where she's an associate professor of history and author of The Politics of Public Housing, Black Women's Struggles Against Urban Inequality. Rocky Barros is with us. He is director of community building, Jacobs Center for Neighborhood Innovation in San Diego. Gus Newport is with us, former mayor of Berkeley, California from 1979 to 1986, and former executive director of the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative in Boston. 410-319-8888 is the number here. So the question is, how do these things change? I mean, for the most part, most places don't do what happened with where you are, Rocky. I mean, that organizations come in and say, we want to embrace the community and really have this conversation. That doesn't happen. Usually the opposite happens. These are developers come in, they want to develop a piece of neighborhood, they do it. We've had public housing that was built, then torn down, with very little input or conversation from people who live in public housing. So we've had less public housing developed. We have less public housing now than we ever had before. If you even have a voucher in cities like Baltimore and Baltimore County, and as many places in the country, the landlords don't have to accept a voucher if you have one. So that limits housing again to what people can get. So the question is, how do things happen differently? Let me give you an example, and I'm curious to see what you all think about this. You may hear about it when you get to Baltimore. In Baltimore, Maryland, there's a neighborhood called the Station North Arts District. It's a neighborhood that people who are listening who live in Baltimore know this area. It's at North and Charles Street, which was for a long time a district with movie theaters in it and a department store. It was a Jewish neighborhood, but it became a black neighborhood for a long time. It still is a majority African-American neighborhood. It is where a theater has opened up, the Charles Theater. Another theater is there. There are restaurants there now. There's a street that divides in some ways where young black people hang out on one side of the street and young white people hang out on the other side of the street. And so this is going to be redeveloped. So the question is, redeveloped as an arts district, but people are asking questions. Will there be affordable housing that artists can actually afford? Will the poor working class people who live in and around that district now, who are mostly African American and Latinos, can they afford to remain in that neighborhood? Will there be mixed housing? Will there be black and white artists? Or is this another case of neighborhoods becoming for mostly white artists and black artists and other artists are not included in it? I mean, so when these kind of things begin to happen, invariably they become designed to brought down from on high, whether it's foundations or city governments that create the design, and no one's involved. So how does that begin to change? How do you do things in a different way? Rhonda, let me just start with you.
I would say, for me, it's in some ways it's a no-brainer. But the key is, how do we get to the no-brainer piece, which is residents have to organize. Residents have to organize. Residents have to build coalitions. Residents have to learn who their neighbors are in order to organize and build coalitions, and begin to develop a unified, not a kind of flat, but a unified message and a strategy that takes into consideration their various perspectives and relationships to community, so that they can then confront power. And I'm going to use the word confront, and I'm going to use the word power, because that's what's at play. I mean, those are words we don't often like to use. We want to say, you know, work it out with people and institutions who have resources to actually better communities. Well, that is true, too. But in many ways, they have to confront power, and you have to really see that relationship as the power of relationships that's linked to financial resources, that's linked to networks, that's linked to corporations and foundations. And so people have to organize. That is at base. And part of that means figuring out what their voice is and articulating that voice. There's various ways that one can do that. First of all, you got to know who your neighbors are. I can't say that enough over and over and over and over again. You got to know who your neighbors are. You got to meet people in community. You have to figure out what your common interests are, right? You have to figure out why it's important for me to be concerned about Mr. Taylor down the street, Ms. Francis up the street, and young Rhonda down the street, you know what I mean? Whatever the names are, whoever the people are. And then begin to say, what are our shared interests, right? So not only what are our individual interests, but then what are our shared interests? And begin to develop networks and actions to really deal with that. Some of this means, you know, you might have to develop a core team. You might have to deal with figuring out, you know, how do you get the research done that's necessary for you to be able to go and confront power, or to be intellectually engaged with a breadth of information to know what it is people are talking about when they have you at the table. See, because part of it is this, right? Once you get beyond all that and residents organize and they figure out what their individual interests are and their shared interests and they develop their voice and their unified strategy and agenda, being at the table in and of itself is not necessarily going to translate into you having power,
mm-hmm.
right? And so there's that other side of that about now figuring out who your allies and your champions are, in addition to the residents who are in neighborhood. Who can you coalition with, whether it's institutions of higher learning, whether it's other grassroots organizations in the neighborhood and or in the entire city or the region? Who can you go to who are scholars, people in the health field who actually have the interests of people at the center, as opposed to their own self-interest of moving forward their careers or whatever else they want to do, right? Mm-hmm. And so a lot of that is actually struggling on the ground, hard, laborious, nitty-gritty work. And, you know, one of the things that Gus said when he first opened up with his comments was they began to have town halls. You also have to figure out the kind of venues you want to open up so that people can begin to organize and to also meet others who may be their allies and champions at the same time, and to be able to provide those venues where that kind of information can be shared, information about financial resources, information about strategic visioning that's coming from the other side, just even basic information about what does this organization, institution, corporation, or foundation stand for and what has been their track record. So that kind of information flow needs to begin to happen as well.
And Gus, since your name was raised, let me bring you right back in here. I mean, as a former mayor, I mean, you at Berkeley and then doing your work in Boston, you can maybe give some advice to the other B, which is Baltimore. so having done it from both ends, what have you learned from that experience?
And let me say, I spent some time in Baltimore also.
Good.
I did some work with the Casey Foundation and in the early days of SMEAC when Marcel and them, where I did a little bit of stuff with them, and I actually did some assessment on Sandtown and some other things, which are uh-huh. some of the real tragedies of when you look at them. I won't go into depths of those. But in Berkeley, which is on the surface a very progressive place, I began to see the class interests making mm-hmm. sure that low-income people, you know, didn't really have the voice, nor did they allow us to build an integrated sort of community in places where we were. And that began to really turn me off because I cut my teeth in the civil rights movement. I mean, I grew up in Rochester, New York, a city that had two race riots. And I was traveling with Malcolm X, who I befriended 4 days before he was assassinated. So I cut my teeth in the civil rights movement. I had gotten fed up with Berkeley. I was invited to the University of Massachusetts Boston as the first senior fellow at the William Monroe Trotter Institute, teacher course on alternative planning, and to do some policy work with black and Latino state legislatures and municipal legislatures. People from the Dudley Street Project began coming to my classes and eventually invited me to come out and spend time with them on the weekends. Now, as I believe Ms. West, the previous speaker, just said, you've got to do some extremely drastic things sometime in order to get people of the community at a common table. And a common table is one that is not set. Everybody sets together.
Mm-hmm.
But Boston had done something. The people had put a ballot initiative on saying that this particular area where Dudley Street was wanted to secede from the city of Boston. And that became national and international news. And the power structure just didn't know what to do. And if they had won that ballot initiative, they would have succeeded from Boston because they were saying that all the poverty money and everything else that went to the city of Boston was being spent to rebuild downtown. It was not coming into the community areas.
Mm-hmm.
Community people began to understand that. So as we were getting ourselves together, one of the first things we did if we got our organizations, we hired a facilitation firm to teach facilitation skills to parents in the low-income community, young people, nonprofit organizations, small businesses, so each could learn how to engage each other to come up with a plan of their own to be incorporated. And then we began to look at the median cost of housing in Boston in those days was $450,000 to $500,000. Community people understood that through urban renewal, every time a new section was taken, they were gentrified out.
That's right.
So they wanted some form of housing that they could own would fit their income. And that's when we did some research and did come up with a community land trust strategy where a nonprofit organization owns the land. The land is used as collateral and whatever else. The community can become homeowners, but they don't own the land under it. But at least it stabilizes their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Then we began to look at transportation factors and all kinds of things to give them access to where jobs were as we were getting more businesses move in. But I'll tell you, I've been a part of four or five community building initiatives. I've never been a part of a successful one that hasn't had university assistance. What do I mean by that? In Boston, Sonny Lee, who was the dean of the Department of Urban Studies and Planning, provided all his students to us to gather data, GIS maps and everything else. And as we translated those and began to give a vision and a few to people, that was an education for the people on the ground. But also with this data, it was a way for us to inform banks how something like this could be financed. And, of course, we got our big start when we were able to get a $2 million program-related investment from Ford Foundation to purchase the land and use the land as collateral to go forward and get planning money, development money, structure, et cetera, et cetera. And the community was learning that step by step. This became a third language to community people, all this stuff. If we go downtown to talk with the mayor and other people, I went with them, but I didn't do the talking. We briefed the community and let them do the talking. And eventually, the city government started coming in, where do these people learn all this stuff? I said, you know, it's a shame that we don't give people credit for the intelligence they have just because of the income levels they might be in due to circumstantial things.
That's
and that's what it is. It's engaging everybody so we go together as a common team. The other thing is a lot of people who are service providers, affordable housing people, are focus on their particular thing. It's a categorical approach that limits the greater potential of what these communities can be. So they take their own piece and build it against anything, and they never bring people to the table to let them plan and look at where they'd like to see this stuff built, where they'd like to see open house, et cetera, et cetera. And we got to remember, not only is it failed public policy, well, it's all failed public policy because during urban renewal, we built 48 million miles of federal freeway right through the inner cities for the most part.
Right.
Dissected the economical areas. Deindustrialization, where all the manufacturing jobs went overseas, which caused the Rust Belt, in the Northeast, et cetera, whatever else. But we never look at these things. And being a former politician, I'll tell you that developers underwrite most political campaigns. They're the ones that put up the money, and they control where things happen, and that's why they were able to just dry up the inner cities and begin moving to the malls and the suburbs, et cetera, whatever else. And as community people learn that, they recognize the train is out of the station, but we got to get in front of it and stop it.
So
we got to come back. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, guys. Finish your sentence. I'm sorry.
No, that's it. Go ahead.
I'm curious, Maricela, before I bring Rocky back in, I'd like everybody to jump in as much as they like here in the last 10 minutes of this program. I mean, so when you hear, guys, you heard Rhonda, and we get to Rocky here in 1 second again, what is it you want to get out of this conference? I mean, what is it that Baltimore needs to get out of this conference? And, I mean, because you want people to come to this conference. I mean, just regular folks in Baltimore. This is not just for...
Right. It's a day to bring people together from all the different pieces of development. And the focus is, there's a couple of focus. One is to start bridging that gap between the different sectors of development. What does that mean? That means that, of course, the residents need to be at the table. They need to be involved. But everything else that goes into making a community whole, that means housing, that means economic opportunity, that means transportation, that means education, that means health, that means social services, that means recreation, that means safety. We have to start thinking in this holistic way, that the only way we can really rebuild a whole community is to look at all the pieces that make a person whole. And in order to do that, that means we need to have everybody at the table when we're talking about community development. So we're trying to bring that type of audience together, which is why the different panelists are representing that broad constituents. Then the other thing is to highlight alternative ways that we're doing development already in this country. The thing I'm so tired of hearing, especially in this EBDI project and this Hopkins expansion in East Baltimore from the Casey Foundation, from EBDI, is, we just don't know any other models. We just don't see anything that works. So this is why we're experimenting with this. Well, this is not true. This is just not true. This is not factual. As Rocky mentioned, here's a project that has shown that it can do it differently. Just as Gus mentioned, here's another one that showed it could do it differently. And what I highlight in my book, a whole chapter I spend describing different projects around this country and outside the country that has different aspects of community rebuilding that has done it differently, that has included community, and that has come to some good outcomes. They may not have had all the pieces together, but they certainly had looked at different pieces and figured out how to accommodate certain pieces to get a better outcome. So a big part of this day is to highlight alternatives, help people to start see that there are other models, there are other ways, and share that information so that people can go back into their local neighborhood and community and start to implement that. A big issue is that we don't share the information about what's going on in other places. So people, we're kind of all in our little silos, researchers, academicians, organizers, policy folk, community on the ground. We don't see that other people are doing similar things or not similar things that we could benefit from or learn about obstacles that didn't work this way. The idea at the conference or the day is also to share what's worked, what's not worked, get people talking, and hopefully get some lessons so people can take back. One of the big things we're going to do is ask people to fill out a form and tell us what have they learned from this day, and what specific things they're going to take back and try to implement in their community. And then we're going to summarize that information, send it back to them in a couple months, and let them know that we're going to be getting back in touch with them in a year and asking them what has worked, what hasn't worked. And we're going to keep that network of connections. And why? Because we are tired of foundations like the Casey Foundation and these other big foundations and these policy think tanks gathering information in places that are doing rebuilding, not bringing it back into the community that needs to benefit so that when development happens, they are informed. Like Gus was saying, they need to be able to be facilitators of the process. And the way that happens is being able to have that information, that knowledge that was gained in their community. We want to stop this knowledge hoarding that occurs that allows certain people to come into community and feel like they can tell community what's best for them. We want to share that information. We want to bring it back into the community so community can be empowered themselves to be able to advise processes that are best for them. So this day asks a lot. It asks a lot of the panelists, but it also asks a lot of the audience. And that is to say, yeah, this is not a one-day thing. This is a process that will continue. Come engage with us. Let us start to do development differently. Let us learn from what has worked. Here are some examples. Ask questions, learn from it, and figure out how you can take pieces of it and bring it back into the community. Next time you go to a meeting or you hear someone's going to talk about development one way, well, you know, raise your voice and say, well, you know what? I heard something 6 months ago, and they did this in their community. In San Diego, the community became investors in a plaza. How come we don't have that in East Baltimore? How come we don't build a shopping center in this 88 acres where a community becomes shared owners in the businesses? This is what the day is trying to do. The day is trying to model alternatives, help people become informed, owners of their education, owners of their destiny, so they can inform a process.
I just want to get in because I want Rocky to have a chance to come back in here before the end of the hour, because what you're just saying, and Rocky, describe it, I really want to know, and I think it would be interesting for our listeners to know, when you talked about the way you developed that land was developed in San Diego, how has the community benefited? In what real way has the community around it benefited, and how has it changed people's lives, economically, socially? I mean, has it, or is it just look nice?
Yeah, well, I just want to add also that, you know, one of the things that was really important for us, too, when we started this, because, you know, we had to build a relationship as well, you know, with this community, and it takes both, you know, internal and external relationships and resources to make this happen. But I think one of the things that was really critical in the beginning was really agreeing to some guiding principles and some values that we could agree on as we moved forward. Mm-hmm. And so our commitment, part of these guiding principles, you know, was to listen and learn together, to build relationships around trust, and then to build capacity and eventually for the community to actually own, you know, not only the process and the work, but actually the assets that were developed here. So I think those things have been really critical. You know, what has changed in the community? I mean, you know, so here was a community that, you know, for 30, 40 years didn't have, you know, a major grocery store, and so now they have one in this community. Here was a community that at the time when we started here, you know, we were looking at about $60 million a year that was leaking outside of this community, and now we've, with Market Creek Plaza, we've been able to recapture about $52 million of that leakage. Mm-hmm. You know, here was a community that in these, you know, 52 acres that, you know, that we're developing, when we started, I think had maybe, you know, I don't know, four or five jobs, you know, and now, you know, we've got somewhere about 400 jobs, you know, in this area. And so I think, you know, those are some of the critical things of how, you know, the community has changed. I think also the impact that it's had is now we have a lot of not only, you know, groups in this community, but even the city. Even I remember the, you know, the Chargers came into this community, and they all started with listening meetings, which, you know, past you had never heard of a listening meeting. They didn't really exist. And so people realized that we had these listening meetings. And I think the other thing that has been really critical is that, you know, every 3 months we hold what we call a village center meeting, which is open to the entire community here to come and to get updated on the work that's going on, and also to push back, you know, if there are certain things that they're not comfortable with or other things that need to be addressed or whatever. At every quarter they have this opportunity, and that has become, you know, a pretty popular meeting, in that not only do the residents from this community come, but law enforcement comes to it, city officials come to it, government agencies come to it, you know, other nonprofits, institutions, education, you know, a lot of people come to this meeting as well. So I think those are some of the things that that I think are critical. And I think for some of the folks that aren't accustomed, you know, to being that civically engaged, because you have some folks that are that have been civically engaged, you know, but then you have a large group of folks that have never been that engaged. And so, you know, for those folks, what I've heard that's been important to them is that there is this new sense of hope, a new sense of hope that their community is going to change, a new sense of hope.
Rocky, I'm sorry, I want to have to interrupt this. We're just about out of time, and I want to get something in here. And I want to thank all, I guess, first of all, Rocky Barros, Gus Newport, Dr. Rhonda Williams, and, of course, Dr. Maricela Gomez for being here. And I hope this has whetted your appetite to come Saturday. And Maricela, tell folks again before we have to go how to be in touch very quickly.
Right. So if you need to get more information, send an email to Social Health Concepts, just like it sounds, SOCIALHELT Concepts@gmail.com. And let us know if you're interested in coming.
Can people just show up?
Well, we're hoping you let us know because we want to make sure we have enough food for you. That's an important piece. We're also charging a fee of $40 registration for residents, community residents. There's scholarship. And for students and community organizations, there's a sliding scale. So we're asking you to let us know so that we can make sure we can accommodate everyone. There is a phone number, but I certainly can't remember it right now. If you have the flyer in front of you,
let's see if we have plenty very quickly. I do not see a phone number on the flyers. Location: St. George's College, 2 North Central Avenue.
We do have a phone number.
We'll put it up on our website and we'll announce it tomorrow if we can find it.
Yeah, and just if you go to that website, and if you don't have internet access, but you know someone, ask them to go to the website and let us know.
Maricela Gomez, thank you so much. We'll get people to come there, and I want to thank all three of our guests as well, Rhonda Williams, Rocky Barros, Gus Newport. Glad you'll be in Baltimore. We'll see you all this Saturday. Thank you so much for being on the air with us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been great to have you all with us. And on the way out of here, I'm going to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late? Don't wait. If you're struggling with your mortgage, the state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's National Foreclosure Settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information at mdhope.org or at 877-462-7555. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Mark Gunnery, and Stephanie Mavronis. Our intern is Lila Warshaw. Our engineer tonight is Andrew Holt. Theme music by Wal Matthews, A Clean Cut. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care and stay tuned. Learn to do with your money. Don't go away.